Welcome. We're back to Division 1 for our 230 docket, which is only the case of United States v. Harris. And let me just briefly review our procedures. As you know, we have 15 minutes for each side, and you can gauge your time by the digital timer or by the color-coded timer, which goes from green to amber to red when your time is up. You should know that we've read the briefs, and at least one of us has had the opportunity to review the record. And as you may know, the three of us were the ones who decided this case originally back in 19.
Two of you.
Well, we were the same division who decided the case in 1998 with Judge Rothenberg dissenting.
We're not the same division. We're similarly constituted.
And you should know also that the oral argument is recorded and it's posted on the internet. So if there's any confidential information, you may be wish to be careful as to how you refer to any confidential or private information. And there's a toggle switch on the podium that you may use to raise or lower it. And finally, I would ask if anybody has a cell phone to make sure that it's turned off, so it doesn't interrupt us during the argument. And with that, we're ready to proceed. And again, I'd like to say we're glad to have Judge Sandra Rothenberg, a senior judge, join us this afternoon.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Kathleen Zaleski.
Excuse me, could I ask you to speak a little bit louder, please?
Oh, sure. May it please the court. My name is Kathleen Zaleski.
That's much better. Thank you.
Thank you. Attorney registration 37752, and I represent David Eugene Harris on his appeal of his 35C motion. Your Honor, this case is a due process case. And
why do you think, first of all, let me mention, this is pure happenstance that I have been got assigned here. The regular judge is on vacation. I wanted to ask you, why do you think the Supreme Court, and normally when it remands, it's going to say in the, to us, the court can, should look at all the issues that were unresolved. Why didn't that happen here, in your opinion?
Well, I think that most likely, it was pure oversight.
Okay. And so then the next question is, why didn't his counsel go back? I guess that's your argument. As a matter of law, counsel would see that there were four issues unresolved. Admittedly, I referred to them in passing, but no, there was no substantive discussion of those issues.
Well, I think that the reason was that my client was prejudiced by the fact that, unfortunately, he had to have substitute appellate counsel when it did go up to the Supreme Court. And so, as you all are familiar with this case, the record is extensive, and I believe that it was oversight on his part, too.
Are we precluded from addressing him now?
No. And I believe that you have an obligation under the Constitution to address it.
If we do decide to address it, do you need to file supplemental briefs because so much time has passed?
I don't believe so. I don't believe it needs to be rebriefed, and I don't believe it needs to be remanded.
What about the question of the standards of Strickland? I assume that you agree that those apply on this appeal, right?
Absolutely. For both substitute appellate counsel and for 35C counsel.
So to that extent, then, don't you have to show, in effect, that this is like an appeal within an appeal, that you would have prevailed on, or Mr. Harris would have prevailed on at least one of the four issues that were not addressed before?
No. This, what's before you right now is a procedural due process claim. It does not reach the substantive claim. He would be prejudiced merely by the fact that he has four undecided issues.
But let's say, if we assume that there are, I mean, it's clear that there are four undecided issues, but if those are issues that would not have led to a reversal of Mr. Harris's conviction, how can we show, or how can you show that it was prejudicial under the Strickland standards so as to require a reversal in this case?
Because we're basing it on a procedural due process right.
But I know that you say that it's a procedural due process right, but you also said that you also agreed with me that Strickland applies, and Strickland requires a showing of both conduct that was below the normal standards for attorneys or appellate attorneys, as the case may be, and prejudice to the defendant.
Well, I believe Strickland applies because I do believe that counsel was ineffective at both levels. However, as Your Honor has pointed out, you know, it's a constitutional claim. He has a constitutional right, and I think if we, you know, it should be viewed outside of Strickland on those grounds.
What's the remedy? I mean, if he's been denied some sort of procedural due process right, what's the remedy?
The remedy is simply to have you revisit the case and make a decision on each of those four claim issues.
So as I understand your argument, the prejudice is as a matter of law in not having four appellate issues decided that he has a statutory right to appeal, constitutional right to appeal, and those four issues were left undecided. And you don't have to show your position is that he would have prevailed, just that he was prejudiced by not even having us look at those issues.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
But how is that consistent with case law that we have on ineffective assistance of appellate counsel that holds that appellate counsel has to show, I mean, that the counsel raising ineffective assistance of appellate counsel has to show that the defendant would have prevailed on appeal but for the actions of the appellate counsel?
As I state in my reply brief, I think it's clear that had substitute appellate counsel written a quick two-page motion to stay the mandate in this case, that when the record was reviewed, and I quote, you know, as you acknowledged, Judge Talman, that it's clear that you did not address the other issues raised by the defendant, that had substitute appellate counsel simply filed that simple motion with the Supreme Court, that the Supreme Court would have recognized that it had overlooked the fact that there were four open issues in this case, and it would have been sent back, and we wouldn't have had to wait 9 years for me to be here before you. So at this time, Your Honors, we ask that you review those four issues and make a decision in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Zaleski.
You don't have any trouble with that, do you?
What's that?
That seems like an eminently reasonable request. You don't have any problem with that, do you?
Well, should I say my name first, or should I? Okay.
Please state your name for the record.
Wendy Ritz, representing the people in this matter. I think what I'm having trouble with right now is exactly what the defendant wants. He has started out alleging ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, which is what was the 35C motion, and also raised some other claims in his trial court 35C motion. The 35C hearing apparently focused only on the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel and not the other 35C claims. He appeals. He asks this court to remand to raise ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel. And the opening brief focuses on the denial of that remand. And now in the reply brief comes back, and the reply brief again asserts both ineffective assistance of appellate and post-conviction counsel. So I'm not certain where the post-conviction stuff stands, where the other stuff stands. As to the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, I think counsel is confusing. There are two types of those claims. There are claims where counsel fails to perfect an appeal at all, and in those kind of cases, there is no need to show prejudice. Essentially, the remedy is you get to have your claims heard. In cases where an appeal is filed and the claim is that you didn't effectively litigate that appeal, then the Strickland prejudice standard applies in that you have to show you would have prevailed on the claims that were not raised in order to win. So it seems to be a merging of those two standards here, perhaps because it's kind of an oddly postured case.
It is, because he or she filed the appeal, but in fact it's almost as if counsel didn't file an appeal because they didn't make sure the Supreme Court sent it to us, which is obviously what would have happened, should have happened.
Right. Although in some sense, I'm not certain it was completely an oversight. I think given Judge Rothenberg's dissent mentioning the claims, and I think given there was a brief mention of we're not going to address the other claims, I think it could be that the Supreme Court felt that essentially they had been rejected.
Would you ask them for us?
I would love to, but...
I'm not sure how you could draw that inference when the majority opinion didn't address or acknowledge even that there were four other issues.
I think there was a brief sentence at the very end where you just kind of said, we don't need to address the other issues because given the disposition that we've reached. There was something to that effect at the end. And then there was Judge Rothenberg's mention. But either way, essentially where we are now is that if this court can say those four claims lack merit, which I think neither side has briefed those issues again. We all seem to be relying on the direct appeal briefs, which the people feel appropriately address the issues. If this court looks at those and says they lack merit, then I think this court can resolve it and say there is no ineffective assistance of appellate counsel.
Do you agree with your comment that if we decide to look at the issues on the merits, we don't need supplemental briefs? The law has not changed in 10 years?
I mean,
it's changed in other areas.
I don't want to go that far. I think several of the issues related to habitual criminal, there was a failure to hold a suppression hearing. It could be that they are the type of claims that the law has not changed that much. I have not reviewed them carefully. I know that one of the issues that was addressed was a hearsay, which we have all the complications of Crawford now, but that claim has already been addressed, and I think so.
Well,
that's
at least with respect to this, we seem to be flying by the seat of our pants. I mean, do you want some time to review that and submit anything additional?
I don't think so.
We decided we'll just go ahead and decide those issues.
I think they were appropriately briefed in the initial appeal. I think both attorneys who represented both the public defender and the assistant attorney general were experienced counsel. I think the issues were well briefed. I think neither one of us re-raised them. I think even in the 35C issues, essentially they pulled from those briefs. So I think it would certainly be one way to resolve the cases for this court to review those briefs. And assuming that you do that and decide that that's not enough, I guess at that point you could request that we do something more. I do question what defendant is intending as to all the other stuff that has been raised along the way, if that's being abandoned now. And this, I mean, that's the part I'm uncertain of what's happening. And I guess our position is, I guess the defendant will have to sort that out with
counsel.
When
you say other stuff, do you mean the allegations of ineffective assistance of 35C counsel?
That, and also the other claims that were raised in the post-conviction motion that was filed in the trial court, which raised ineffective assistance of appellate counsel and some other issues. I think some trial counsel issues and proportionality, some other legal claims were presented. And it seems at this point perhaps they've been abandoned. I'm not certain of that. And under Silva, it would appear that the defendant can come back and raise ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel if he feels that's necessary to get those other claims addressed. So I guess those issues can be left to another day. Our position essentially is that the Strickland standard applies, and there has to be a determination of whether he would have prevailed on any of the issues. And we think he would not have, certainly, as Judge Rothenberg pointed out in her dissent, and I think as was written in the appellate brief and our appellate brief, the issues lacked merit. Beyond that, unless there are any further questions, I would ask that the convictions be affirmed.
I have an unrelated question, may I ask it, since you have 8 minutes left?
Certainly.
If we have a case involving a waiver, for example, hypothetically, the waiver of a jury trial, we find that there was error, does Blaine require that we send it back for a hearing, or can we decide whether it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt here?
I wish I had just read Blaine today. I would have.
Blaine requires, in Curtis advisements, in that context, a 35C, and they've expressed a clear preference for hearings, but it seems incongruous. Most of the discussions beyond a reason, whether there was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, have historically been made by the court. Do you have any opinion on that?
Off the cuff, I hesitate to answer. I did not hear the complete argument ahead of us.
And
I'm not, you know,
I apologize.
I wish I was more up on that area of the law, frankly. I am not. So I
have a few other questions, but I'll let those go.
I'm very well versed on ineffective assistance of appellate counsel right now. If you have,
well, let's ask you that. You're an experienced counsel. Both sides have filed excellent briefs in this case. Isn't it ineffective as a matter of law in this case not to have reminded the Supreme Court your client has four unresolved issues?
It certainly would have made everyone's lives easier if, when the case came back down, and counsel saw that nothing had been indicated in the order sending it back, to file a motion suggesting that those issues should be reconsidered. It seems to me that's probably what has happened in other cases.
Always move to withdraw the mandate also. I mean, they're
correct.
Relatively liberal in doing that within a reasonable period of time and then address the unresolved.
Yeah, assuming counsel waited, thinking maybe that this court was going to issue another decision and the mandate issued, at that point, you would think perhaps they would say, excuse me, court, could you take a look at this and let me know if you overlooked this? That seems like it would have been the more appropriate course. But even if that's the case, the remedy is simply you get the issues heard. You
right.
don't then get a new trial. That your due process right is to have those issues heard. So that's what you get.
And that's all she's asking
right.
for here.
Exactly.
So you agree with her?
I would say that that is an appropriate way to deal with the case at this point. It seems like it would probably.
As to appellate counsel.
As to appellate counsel. As to post-conviction counsel, our position is that it's not properly before the court at this point.
Well, it may even be moot.
Exactly. If this court addresses the claims now, the post-conviction issue might go away because the defendant might get what he's looking for. Beyond that, if the court has no further questions, I would ask that the defendant's convictions be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ritz.
We have any other problems?
Quite a few. Quite a few.
Any rebuttal, Ms. Lesky? Okay, well, thank you very much, both of you, for your